Hi, everybody. You're listening to the third Gamers Confab that I recorded as part of Podcast 25. In this segment, my guests are game writer and narrative designer Sandy Chen, who also edits the game design aspect of the Month blog, Justin Cavern of Groping the Elephant, and Roger Travis of the Living Epic blog and the Video Games and Human Values Initiative. My thanks to Sandy, Justin, and Roger for joining me on the Confab. I hope you enjoy. It's my pleasure to welcome three guests to the Gamers Confab, two newcomers and one regular, it's a great thrill to have all of you on. First, I'll begin with Sandy Chen. Sandy is the editor of the Game Design Aspect of the Month blog, which I highly recommend that you not only read but subscribe to it. It's a blog, as the name would suggest. She and guests, designers, authors, writers, focus on various aspects of game design and generate conversations there on those topics. And she is also, of course, a writer and a video game designer. And some of her credits include PC RPG The Witcher, which many of you have probably played. That game, she was nominated for a Writers Guild Award in video game writing. And you wrote, is this right, Sandy, the 1999 Independent Games Festival winner, Terminus, is
yes. Also your game. Yes, I was a screenwriter on that.
Indeed. So, Sandy, it's a great pleasure to have you on. Welcome to the Gamers Confab.
Thanks for having me.
My next guest is Justin Cavern. Justin writes the Groping the Elephant blog, which, as I said previously when we recorded this, and I screwed up the recording, so I'll say it again, even though it won't be funny twice. It's my favorite name for a blog on the internet, I think. Groping the Elephant is just perfect. Justin, thank you for joining me. Welcome to the Gamers Confab.
Thank you, Mike. It's nice to be here.
And finally, an old friend, Roger Travis. Roger is a professor of classics at the University of Connecticut, and you would probably know him from the Living Epic blog, which he's been writing for. What? How long have you been doing that, Roger?
Two years now. I think.
Yeah, about the same time as Brainy Gamer, I think.
Yeah, a few months later, but of course I don't keep it up anywhere near as well as you do.
Well, you know, you've got other things to do. Among the other things that Roger does is he's the co-founder with me of the Video Games and Human Values Initiative, and VGHVI is an ongoing effort with a pretty significant number of people involved now, including some of your classes.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of an largely empty basket made up of a whole bunch of people who game together on Thursday nights and kind of weave their different, oh my goodness, what a bad metaphor. But the reason it's empty is that we are constantly trying to get people to fill it with money. In which case we could do wonderful things like having fellowships for people like all of the great people you have in the Gamers Confab. Yeah. So if you know of anybody who wants to put money in that kind of basket, you can always let me know.
Okay. I'll do my best. You know.
Thanks.
The economy's perfect. You know, lots of people want to give us money.
Exactly. Thanks for having me, Michael.
My pleasure. And I should also mention, just it occurs to me, we should also mention Jeff Howard, who played a big role also in getting the VGHVI.
Yes, and there's an occasional podcast, and Jeff Howard contributed one of the interviews there, and that interview well repays the listen, I think.
Beautiful.
So look for the podcast. VGHVI is the only organization that has the abbreviation VGHVI, so feel free to Google it.
Excellent. And just before we jump in, just one more quick little plug. I'd mentioned Justin's blog. He wrote a post called Meaningful Actions, where he talks about, you know, what gamers are really doing and when they play games. It's a great essay, and it plugs into some things that a lot of us have been talking about, and he kind of distills a few things that I thought were very useful. So he's always up to something interesting, but I would plug that particular post as especially interesting to those of you who are interested in game design.
While you're plugging Justin, can I plug something for him too, which is an upcoming piece that he's going to have at VGHVI, the inaugural piece of our proceedings about Assassin's Creed, which I've been privileged to work on him with over the last month or so. And it should go up soon. And it's, I think, going to be a really interesting experiment in how academic writing on games might go further than academic writing on other subjects has managed to go in terms of being useful to the critical community.
Great.
So stay tuned on VGHVI for that.
Okay. So I think we're plugged out.
Give me a lot to live up to now.
Well, let's begin with Sandy. Sandy, welcome again to the podcast. And I pitched a question to you and the same question to all three to think about this year up to this point, kind of before the big rush of games comes at Christmas, and you know, the increasingly large number of delayed games which will come after Christmas, but maybe a good time to look at 2009 and where we've been and what particular issues or people or games that struck you as being particularly notable. So we'll begin with you, Sandy, and off we go.
Okay, thanks. So I've been looking a lot at social games, which is games that are played over social networks like Facebook and MySpace. And if you went to Casual Connect, you might have noticed that like social games were really big then. And in fact, they compared it to the time when cars were being given away by casual game companies at parties. So, I mean, there's a lot of investment going on in these social game companies. And I wrote an article for Gamma Sutra about social games, just trying to give an introduction to them and look through all the games. And when we look at it, the game mechanics are very simple. In fact, a lot of times things are reduced down to a button press. And we did talk about this on Game Design Aspect of the Month in a topic called Trends of Simplicity. But when I the comments to my article on Gamma Sutra, what I found interesting was that some people were really angry that there's no challenge to these games, that somehow we're dumbing down games. So my question here is that, is there like a challenge level for games? Why is it that, you know, the mainstream can't have enjoy all the things that we like in RPGs or MMOs and just it's not as hard? I mean, is there something about these games that really tick you off?
What do you guys think about that? It does interest me. I think over the last, say, 18 months or so, I see a fair number of conversations. And there, you're right, Sandy, there's often like vituperation involved, you know, where people get very upset about either length of games or difficulty of games. What's that all about?
Well, the thing that I wanted to bring up actually, I think, dovetails really nicely, which I'm sure was your intention, Michael, because I was absolutely fascinated in July when Dennis Dyack, and I may be mispronouncing his name, I realize now, apparently said at a conference in the UK that gameplay, he thought, was going to become less important. Not that it was going to become unimportant, but that a different balance was progressively going to be struck. And it strikes me that what Sandy's talking about and what the commenters on Gamma Sutra seem to be reacting to is this feeling that what game aficionados over the last few years have thought of as the distinguishing element of what makes our passion and our art form different from other passions and art forms is what has been thought of as gameplay. And now that it appears that perhaps that's not all that it was supposed to be, not the absolutely defining part of what makes games games, I think people are starting to get a little bit nervous. And the reaction to what Dennis Dyack said seems to reflect that. I mean, I'm actually looking right now at the thread on Gamma in reaction to Dyack's comments. And it's the same thing that I found in some of the comments when I went so far as to say that Halo and BioShock were profound, just using that word, that unless for some of these connoisseurs, unless there is a major advance in gameplay and unless the gameplay really reflects, and here I think it dovetails with what Sandy is talking about, unless it reflects some sort of credibility in terms of complexity and difficulty, it's not going to be what we think of as something that goes with gaming. And instead, it becomes that other bad thing, which is sometimes called filmic. And one of the things that Dyack was talking about was you need to embrace the similarities between games and film rather than saying that.
Though I think he was talking about bigger games. I mean, though they do say that the killer MMO might be something played over social networks. And instead of gameplay, I think gameplay is important in social games. We see that Playfish is doing, Playfish. I get them mixed up with Play First. They're like similar names. but they're doing really well on Facebook. So what I do see is that a lot of these social games, especially like Mafia Wars, they're adopting a lot of the core mechanics of MMOs. But it's still at a very simplified way. It's you don't really have to kill the mobs. You just press a button. And so for me, I do feel that is sort of empty, that all I have to do is press a button. It's like I have a cheat with me when I'm playing World of Warcraft or something. I never really have to do anything. I just press a button. I think what it is that it's looking at people's time and how can they include games in their lives, which I think is interesting about social games, is that maybe the social aspect of it is more important than the complicated gameplay.
Right. Which opens up the possibility of bringing more and different kinds of gamers into the community, right? That if you make a game somewhat easier, clean up the interface, you make it less layered, and maybe you add a social dimension to it that, you know, people could carry over from other activities that they're more familiar with. You've opened up games to, areas of their demographic groups, let's say, that aren't typically playing games, or they're playing other kinds of very casual games.
Right.
Yeah, I think the comparison to film is, again, unavoidable, that it's only when film language becomes stable and the mainstream is able to become conversant with it. Things from kind of Griffith to Wells, finally, that people are flocked to the movie theaters in droves because they're going to understand what's going on. And I think what's happening with, say, Mafia Wars on Facebook is that more and more people feel like they understand the mechanics.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a vernacular, basically.
Exactly.
Well, how does this affect your work, Sandy? I mean, how does this conversation affect the way you think about doing your work?
You know, I think for casual games, the stories have not been so spectacular. You know, so like I even said, like Diner Dash maybe has like a one sentence story. and then if you look at social games, do they have a story? I mean, like I'm planting stuff in my farm. Yay. but I think there is a possibility of more and better games, especially when you look at Flash will have 3D soon that they can put on Facebook. And so you can have these more immersive sort of virtual worlds. I'm not sure if something like Dare.com is going to do well on... I was never quite sure why I need like a second life right now, or third life, because if I'm already on an MMO and I'm two characters and now it's like fourth life.
which MMO are you playing?
I am playing the MMO that I told you. I'm on Wizard 101.
Of course.
Yeah,
oh, my kids love that.
Can we just throw in one more plug?
Okay, yeah. I was a writer on Wizard 101, and I have a level 50 Grandmaster balance character. I love the balance school, and I'm just getting into PvP.
You're kidding. My daughter is going to go crazy when she hears
that I'm a writer. yeah, I really love balance. There are not a lot of balance wizards around, and I love the people on there. So, and I play with kids who don't have the chat, and I play with kids who have the chat, and I've been on there. This is maybe my fourth time going through, because I'm starting over with a necromancer. And I think it takes just, I think balance is very versatile, because it appeals to many different personalities. And it's definitely an interesting school. So if you want to look into it, it's wizard101.com.
Sandy, can I just ask a question?
Okay.
I apologize. This is for me. This is not really related to the podcast. Is, just so I'm not mixing these up in my head, is Wizardry 101 the thing that Tom Hall was involved in?
Yes.
Ah, right, yeah, okay. Sorry,
well, it's his company. He works for the company.
All right.
And this is a game that you wouldn't be surprised how many adults are playing this game.
Given the popularity of Harry Potter among adults, I just wanted to compliment Wizard 101. I think they've managed to deliver Harry Potter in an interactive way without making it feel, to someone like me and my kids who know the Harry Potter universe inside and out, without making it feel stale in any way. And I imagine around Wizard 101, you're kind of not allowed to say that what you're doing it has that strong a relation to Harry Potter. Given that my daughter would love nothing better than to get her letter from Hogwarts, I think that Wizard 101 does a fantastic job of giving that experience to kids and adults, because I guess I would like nothing better than that either.
Oh, thank you. I was mainly involved in the first five worlds, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of the worlds come out.
But there's something to be said about a design philosophy which feels inviting and which, you know, relies on a certain kind of evolution of game design, which says, sort of like, you know, the iPod, right? You can make this really complicated, or if you're really good at it, you can make it easy.
It's principles of usability design. It's the concept that should ideally run through any designed product. You know, you can see what reactions your actions are going to have, and everything's clear and nothing's like hidden. I mean, these are the basic principles of usability design, and I mean, the iPhone's a great example of that, and you know, social network games as well. Everything's very clear. You know what's going to happen when you do something. It doesn't blow everything up if you press the wrong button. Yeah. Just simple things like that.
Well, in some ways, the evidence for the need for this, well, for example, Free Realms has now hit 5 million plus registered users.
Wow.
Right. And I've been writing about this. I haven't been able to sort of make this into a post that fully makes sense. But you know, part of the thing about Free Realms is that it's just genius at teaching you how to play it.
Yeah. And I think what they did was they did a lot of research on kid games and what kids like, and then they stuck them all in one place.
Yeah,
which I think goes along exactly with what Dyack is saying. I have to say that is, it's I think people are up in arms about social games and about other things because there are no advances there. The huge criticism that was leveled against Halo, for example, is that there were no advances in the gameplay. But I think that kind of misses the point of at least in narrative-based games. And I'm actually on a theoretical level not willing to make that distinction, but I'll make that distinction because it seems to make sense to a lot of people that there are games and then there are narrative-based or story-based games. Fine. But in narrative-based games, gameplay is the vernacular. And a game like Free Realms or a game like Wizard 101 succeeds by taking gameplay that people are going to be able to figure out because they've done it before and putting that together in a new and interesting way, a narrative that people want to follow and want to perform for themselves.
Yeah. Right. So like Wizard 101... definitely has a narrative. It has an ending. It has a dramatic ending, and has a dramatic intro as you're introduced to the world. And yet, I mean, I really enjoy that, and I think that there is a push. And many kids' games actually, it is very linear. So it wouldn't be just a setup for MMO saying these guys are fighting against these guys. but you actually follow the story, and you can jump ahead or jump back depending if you have friends in those different zones. But I think they did simplify a lot of some of the mechanics, and it's a good starter MMO because there are kids as young as six on there. And yet it is complex because you need to decide strategically what spells to get and, you know, what equipment to wear. So you do learn a lot about yourself and how you are as a player.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if Roger's point is entirely what people have a problem with when it comes to Dyax. I don't know what you would call it, his manifesto, I suppose. I think when saying games don't necessarily advance, innovative, there we go, in a particular area, there are many examples of games that are popular with, quote-unquote, the hardcore gamer that don't particularly innovate in a specific area. I mean, World of Warcraft, when it was initially released, did very little that hadn't been done in EverQuest and Ultima and various other MMOs before. It just did everything really well. And that's what I think people are interested in more than necessarily advancements. I mean, at the moment, I think everybody on Twitter is playing the new Batman game, Arkham Asylum. And I'll confess, I'm a little addicted to it as well. But there is not a single thing in that game that is an advancement in its genre. There is nothing new about it in any way. I think the fact is, what hardcore, I say, quote-unquote, expect is that actions have a certain low-level consequence. And this is what I think social games don't have that people aren't used to. Social games work on a higher level where one input leads to a chain or a sequence of outputs, whereas with most what people would consider traditional games, one action leads to a single consequence, like you press the button and Mario jumps. Whereas social games and in some way, MMOs are above that, where you press a button and a sequence of events takes place. And that feels like we're losing control. And I think there's a fear of that loss of control that makes it feel like, oh, that's too easy. If I don't have to micro everything, that's too easy. But, I mean, I don't necessarily agree with that. But that's what I think the problem is. Yeah. And Dyax seems to be saying towards that operating on a higher level is okay, and having mechanics that are thematic as opposed to purely mechanical is okay. And I think a lot of people, there's a historical bias towards the assumption that an action should lead to a single consequence. And I'm not sure if that's how I feel, but I think that's how a lot of people feel.
That makes me think of The Path, which is, as I was thinking about what I wanted to bring to the conversation today, I was thinking a lot about the criticism that The Path took. A lot of people going so far as to say that it wasn't even a game. And certainly there's nothing innovative in it. I think an analysis along the lines that Justin just kind of put forward works really well in the case of The Path. That is, any of the things you do in The Path don't have an obvious and immediate consequence. They can uncover parts of the story, but the story is so ambiguous that in your experience of the game and the way that you're going to play the game from that point on, there is an infinite number of possible things that action could have meant.
Just out of curiosity, Sandy, do you have a sense of how many players who came to Wizardry 101 were newcomers to the genre, and how many or what percentage were, you know, transfers?
You know, I don't really know those statistics, but they have over 1 million paying subscribers, or at least people who pay. It is a free-to-play MMO, but there are subscriber zones, or you can pay per month, or you can get a subscription for a year. But my sense is that if we have players that are as young as 6 and 7, then this is their first MMO. I mean, I have talked to one, and they have talked about RuneScape and other ones, but I think Wizard 101 is a much safer place for them. And they talk about Toontown, and this is it's my co-author, David Michael's daughter, Serene. She plays on Wizard 101, and she's been she just likes that she gets stuff. You know, she'd be like, oh, I got another necklace. And so, but she's learning the mechanics of how to play MMO while she's doing this, and learning about the social mechanics of and having friends and friend lists and things like that. And I have several nieces and nephews who their parents wouldn't want them to try like RuneScape because you can't control other people's behavior as much as on Wizard 101, where there are very aggressive filters and they only have menu chat like as in Toontown. But I would think that there are several parents and children playing at the same time, right. And that's where you get the adult contingent, and it's really, I think, the adult contingent that they get into PvP a lot, but there's a lot of kids on there too, so I don't really know, but it is very crowded. Yeah. the realms are very crowded, and they have added more realms.
Well, I've got to check this game out. When we first spoke about this has been months ago, I took a very quick look at it. I was very busy at the time, and so I didn't really jump in, but I find myself suddenly very intrigued by these games, and I mentioned Free Realms as well. I've been really spending a fair amount of time in that game.
I want to see Hello Kitty online. Yeah. I signed up for the beta and I didn't hop on, and I still want to see it.
I do too.
Michael, have you played Club Penguin?
I have, yes. Yeah, I just got into that. I've only been, a month maybe.
But. Yeah, I my son did Wizard 101 for a while and has decided that he wants to go back to Club Penguin, actually. I think mostly because he hadn't earned his black belt at Card Jitsu yet. I've been very impressed by Club Penguin because of the openness of the game to individual players telling their stories. There's a library that's full of stories told by players about their penguins and about the world.
Well, Justin, why don't we throw the ball over to you?
I guess what I've seen recently, especially over the last couple of months, is a certain bizarre trend in the way games are priced and the perception of price among gamers. I mean, very recently, Civilization Revolution was released for the iPhone, and it is, for all intents and purposes, it is the Nintendo DS game, which I believe, you have to bear with me, I may switch between dollars and pounds because I'm confusing exchange rates and such, but Civilization Revolution is still available on Amazon.com for the DS for $20. There seems to be no argument about that being a fair price for a DS game, but the iPhone game is the same game, and it's about $4. And there are people who believe, I've actually heard people saying that $4 is too much for this game, but no one questions whether $20 is okay for the same game on a different platform.
Those are market pressures, though. I mean, just like songs, if you download music, will be around 99 cents, or if it's more popular, maybe a little bit more. Casual games have gone down too. They're maybe $7.99 now. It's simply because how many iPhone applications are there and that they have to compete with? And so if they priced it at $20, would anybody buy it?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, there have been iPhone games that have come out at higher prices, and a big deal has been made about them. I guess I'm not sure. I mean, I understand the need for the definition of casual games, but I've honestly spent more time playing Peggle and Drop 7 on my iPhone than I've spent playing Dead Space at this point. And yet, I myself didn't seem to have a perception problem paying $50, whatever it was, for Dead Space. Yet, a game like Peggle that I know I will probably still be playing, you know, 3 years from now if I've got a platform to play it on, it seemed a bit odd for me to spend $4 on it. I find that quite strange. I mean, what exactly are we paying for?
I mean, the labor. all those workers.
But ideally, to the consumer, labor doesn't... We pay, $299 now for PlayStation 3, but we know that these things must, in terms of the labor to make them, they don't cost that. We're paying for the research and development and all the other things that may possibly have associated and built up a cost towards this device, but to the consumer, none of that really matters. I mean, isn't that the principle of the society we live in, that we pay the price we perceive to be appropriate, and we don't generally concern ourselves with how it's made, which is a terribly, terribly mercenary view.
Well, I think that the trajectory is interesting, or what I thought the trajectory would be on pricing for the iPhone, because, you know, when they first started coming out, when it really sort of exploded, you know, the 99 cent, the $2 game or whatever, they were just everywhere. And of course, most of them were really horrible. But as the games have grown more ambitious and more, you know, respectable, I guess you might say, I'm thinking of a game like Spider, which a lot of us have played recently.
Yep.
My expectation was that as we prove to the market and to the community that these games are really being very carefully designed and that they're really extraordinarily good games, that they'll be able to charge more money for them. And of course, that's not at all the case. Those price pressures seem to be constant, and it doesn't essentially matter whether or not the game is a kind of throwaway or, you know, months of development with, you know, hand-painted backdrops. It's still going to be $3 or $4.
There are some premium-priced games.
Yeah, there are, but not many.
No, I find it curious, though, that Doom Resurrection is one of the... I believe it came out at $10 or something like that, and there was a big deal made about the price of it, but this is unconfirmed, but I'm hearing that was profitable at $10. And obviously the time that must have gone into making that, I don't know if any of you have played it, but it's a 3D rail shooter on the iPhone. The development that must have gone into that must be more than something like Drop 7. And mm-hmm. the price shows that, and people have shown a willingness to spend that. It just,
right.
I guess...
I mean, it's like British Rail. I mean, they just... go for what people are willing to spend, and with the hardcore games. Do you have to explain British Rail?
No, it's I live with
it,
British
it's
Rail.
It's a wonderful economics thing. I mean, I went to London School of Economics, so British Rail was one of these things. I never knew what price I was going to pay when I got there. You know, it was just like. Because they got like Pink Days and whatever. It's you know, it's basically based on the consumer's willingness to pay. And so if we believe that Harker games should be $50 and we're willing to pay them, then that's just what they're going to charge, even though, yeah, because we think the quality of a $50 game is going to be better than a $19.99 budget game. And so that's the price point. So even if it is the same game, I mean... companies do this. They have the same wine, but they package it in a really nice bottle. It's the same wine. They sell it for really expensive prices, $100. And then they put the same wine into a cheap bottle and they sell it for $5. It's just trying to get those two different markets.
What's the name of that wine?
So are we saying the iPhone is a cheap bottle?
Well, I think what it is, is that they're going to get, they might get more iPhone users downloading it than the people buying the $20 version.
Yeah.
So,
but I wonder, is the other side of this, you mentioned the Nintendo DS, you know, what ultimately may become the most successful game platform in history. You've got what seems to be at least fairly rampant piracy going on that platform right now, and this surging iPhone market and more people getting those in their pockets. How sustainable is that model for Nintendo? You know, a $29.99 game.
They seem to be moving towards the maybe very slowly for Nintendo towards the idea of downloadable to hopefully deal with their piracy problem. And I wonder if the fact that they aren't likely to be competing directly with the App Store is going to alter their pricing. But I think trying to predict what Nintendo are going to do is incredibly naive, and greater men have tried.
If you knew that there was a game that you wanted and that it was a full price game on the DS, would you be willing to sort of hope that it might come out for the iPhone and sort of not buy that game? Or if you want the game, you're going to pay $30 or whatever pounds for it?
I think now, especially after playing Civilization Revolution, I would probably be more inclined to wait and see if there was an iPhone version. I mean, a big part of that is simply because the iPhone is with me all the time, and I cannot guarantee that of the DS.
Well, that just the reason I ask is I think this is it. CivRev for the iPhone is a particularly, potentially a particularly pivotal moment, because we never think of the DS as a release as being multi-platform. There, it's just a DS game or it's nothing. You might occasionally see a PSP like Peggle or whatever, but for the most part, that's the one platform that game is designed for. And you know, if suddenly games go multi-platform and you can easily translate a DS game into an iPhone game, all bets are off.
I can imagine that happening with a Lego game.
Yeah.
Right. If Lego, I can't imagine Lego Rock Band, I guess, or maybe I can. But if,
well, you've got the music there, surely.
Yeah. Exactly. So I could definitely see that happening. I'm fascinated because I don't have an iPhone, and so I'm obviously used to DS games, and I've been watching. I mean, it's Spider especially. It was the first thing that really made me think I needed an iPhone. But I wonder if I'm the problem. That is, they're going to keep the games at $5 until I get an iPhone, and then they're going to raise the price to $30.
Yeah, well, I it seems unlikely. I've been amazed at the just really huge angry diatribes you read on the App Store comments about people are just, this is outrageous. $5 for this is insane.
They never had to pay $50 or $60.
Yeah, clearly. Well, Roger, we sort of peeked a little bit at your issue, but did you want to, you know, sort of expand on that a little bit?
I don't think so, except I guess to thank you for recommending Devil Survivor. I actually got the box right here, Shin Megami Tensei, because it seemed to me, along with The Path, to be such a great example of the point that I agree with Dayak about so much, which is that fetishizing gameplay is something that I think is going to fade as we progress, because I think that game, Devil Survivor, is a wonderful example of a game that doesn't introduce anything in terms of gameplay, but rather uses the very robust language of the JRPG to tell a kind of story that hasn't been really told through that medium before. And it makes me think of the development of film and the old question, thankfully, that people have stopped talking about, so probably I shouldn't bring it up, but let me just bring it up as a way to put its tombstone in place, which is, when is our Citizen Kane moment? And it may turn out that we had it with BioShock, but I think it ends up not really being important, because what is important is that vernacular, which I think is Sandy's great term for this, that the language is developing. And maybe one of the things that's holding us back is that the technical skill to create things in that language doesn't necessarily go along so readily with the artistic qualities that people like Sandy as a writer have. I mean, when you think about the new wave in French filmmaking, which followed not all that distantly from Griffith way back at the beginning of the century.
Or neorealism, right?
Exactly. That it was possible for someone like Godard to be an amazing artist in a whole bunch of fields and also to be a filmmaker. It's not, I think, that easy with games. I think you have to develop a team that, from the get-go, destroys the auteur model. And although I think the auteur model is kind of disproven as a theory of how film should be made, nevertheless, it at a crucial moment in the development of film language, it provided an impetus. And I don't think that's really ever going to be possible with games. So in one sense, I think that means that the movement that we want to see is going to be slower with games than it was with film. But on the other hand, I think what Dayak's saying is really compelling, and that's the kind of motion that we're going to be able to watch going forward. And I think we can expect more games like Devil Survivor to bring it full circle. And just to say again, Michael, thank you. I just adore this game.
Oh, I'm glad.
Well, I have been proposing that narrative designers take a little bit of that position that a director or an auteur might have, just to make sure that the artistic sensibilities are consistent throughout all of the mechanics and throughout the game. So usually maybe the creative director might be doing this. It doesn't really have to be the narrative designer, but at least you're giving somebody the responsibility for making sure that this vision is throughout the game.
It's something I've used the term in my own writings before, but it's what I would like to refer to as holistic design. Mm. The idea that everything should serve the central idea. Yeah. I think a big problem with the games industry is that so much of it was and still is tech-driven. I think even at their heart, a lot of designers still consider themselves as part of the tech sector, not part of the entertainment sector. They still think with the left brain as opposed to the right brain. And if we want to really push like the power of narrative in interactive mediums, we need to take the power away from the tech guys and put it in the hands of the artists and say, look, this is the technology we have. Make something incredible with it. But I think we're too concerned with, can we get like the next big evolution in technology? Can we create graphics that are photorealistic, when I would imagine most people don't actually care?
Exactly. Because,
yeah, and it's just creepy when they get to be so close and not really that, you know, they're not human.
There's another problem there, is that not only do they look creepy and seem a bit creepy, but the closer they get to reality, the bigger the gap between how they act and how you perceive they should act becomes. So it's an AI problem and a characterization problem and an animation problem. It's all of these things. And it's only if you're heading every bit of your product towards, say, a narrative goal, or say you have a particular idea of a particular character and you know, backstory elements and who their parents were and you know, anything you need to characterize them. It's only if the artificial intelligence programmer and the gameplay programmer and the animator and the rigger and the concept artist, if they're all working towards creating a fully fleshed out character, that's when it's going to work. But most of the time, the tech guys are doing something totally different, and they don't care who the AI is for. They don't care whether this character is a good guy or bad guy. All they're doing is they're creating something in isolation, an abstract system. And no one's trying to get the technologists to characterize people through behavior and things like that. And that's what I think is the problem with a lack of a holistic vision, a lack of a unifying idea, is that there seems to be, even with those who want a narrative-focused game, there seems to be a gap between the assets and the technology. And the idea is that the technology creates the backdrop and the assets create the character. But there's so much of technology present in games that I think any kind of divide at any level is a bad idea.
That's what I would hope that a narrative designer would be a part of, is just making this a holistically tied together and a cohesive experience for a player.
In this regard, Sandy, I guess, but you know, everyone probably has an opinion about this. How does genre function? Is genre, can it be seen as a kind of a limiting factor, or once you understand how the genre works and it's, I mean, Devil Survivor is a great example of this. Roger's already mentioned it. You know, you've already got this really terrific foundation, then you can really do something with it. But I've often wondered if you are a narrative designer and you want to tell a story in a game, which genre would you choose? Where are you most likely to be able to fully flex your muscles as a storyteller?
I think the way genre is defined in games is kind of proving my point. In most other medium, especially narrative medium, we define genre in terms of theme.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas in games, we define genre in terms of real-time strategy, first-person shooter. It's right. defined in terms of what you do, not right. in terms of the theme. And I think that's a big problem when our mentality is still towards defining a product by what you do rather than the message it gets across. That's a big problem.
I totally agree.
I think it's a little bit oversimplifying in a way that I think ends up being interesting about genre generally outside of games, because the very first genres were defined by occasion rather than by theme, and then sub-genres got kind of down-defined from there. So, for example, even with novel, originally, when you're talking about a novel, you're talking about a specific way of putting a book together out of the printing press. But then that quickly becomes down defined into things like romance, epistolary novel, and these days mystery novel and sci-fi novel. But what I think that means for games is actually just to reinforce the point that you just made, Justin, which is that if you don't think about the different things that genre means, and you only think about what you're doing, then you're going to end up with an experience that doesn't reach its full artistic potential.
The way games define genre seems akin to defining TV shows as a...
like sitcom or something, you know?
Well, no, but more as a one-camera show. Or,
yeah, this is a three-camera show. This is a handheld camera show.
Okay. Yeah.
It's like, it's defining it based on the technology you're using to create something, not what you're creating.
But they do merge frequently. I mean, we were just discussing the JRPG. You could say that there are mechanical similarities that define the genre, but you could certainly also say that there are very frequent repeated tropes and character similarities, and they don't have to be that way. But then the minute you start saying they don't have to be that way, do you always have to have an inventory system then? Do you always have to have is it necessary that each element that we think of as JRPG function in exactly the same way? So then the question of what innovation looks like or what a new idea looks like, it can open up the space quite a bit, because suddenly you've rethought something that which would seem very minor. And I would refer to Devil Survivor again. I'm sorry, people who haven't played it, you should definitely play it. But, you know, it's the little things they do to tweak this, tweak that, and it doesn't feel like a little change. It feels like a big change. Mm-hmm. It feels like a liberating change, and it opens up storytelling possibilities.
No, but I think that's just about asking yourself, of all the tropes and features of this genre, literally, when you're creating the product, asking... why is this the way it is? And sometimes they're the way it is because they work. And sometimes they need a little tweak to be closer to what you want them to work as. And sometimes they just need to be thrown out entirely. And I think it's just having the wherewithal and the willingness to question these game design cliches, for want of a better term.
Well, Sandy, do you feel like you, as a storyteller, that the medium of video games serves your needs? Do you sort of wake up in the morning excited about what you can do, or do you find yourself, do you find yourself bumping against walls that you wish would tumble down?
Well, I've only written for a video game, so I don't know the experiences on TV or say film. I would say that there's so many different types of games, so you end up writing different things, you know, like it was even Wizard 101, you can have a story even though these quests are just like one sentence, two sentences, or three sentences. You can still have a story. In fact, I was hoping that the Writers Guild would consider Wizard 101 as a script that could be nominated instead of, you know, what we traditionally think of, like something like Dead Space or BioShock. And if you look at the first-person shooters, there's often very linear, and we have these cutscenes. So I think even though we have these genres that are based on mechanics and gameplay, it turns out that writing for them, it's very different. That RPG is very different from writing for a first-person shooter or writing for a casual game. So, and then because I'm a freelancer, there's limits to when I'm brought on to the project or if I'm there from the beginning. So I think that we have room to grow. And if it is something that we need to learn the vernacular and how to get the most out of the vernacular, that's part of the process of learning what we can do. There are some walls, I believe, that as writers, we, of course, want to be appreciated. there are probably not as many writers as there are screenwriters for film. So, but I don't think it's something, game writing is not something that a screenwriter can just jump into unless it's a very linear game. And you do have to have a good understanding of how these games work.
It seems most games that have had big name screenwriters have often not been that good, which I think just bears out Sandy's point.
Well, we've reached the end of our time, and I don't know where it went. I want to thank all three of you very much for joining me and for spending time chatting with me. Very kind of you. Sandy Chen from the Game Design Aspect of the Month blog. And Sandy, can you tell us about something you're working on at this point, or are you not allowed to?
In terms of what I'm working on, I can't really talk about. But the Game Design Aspect of the Month blog, gamedesignaspect.blogspot.com. The next topic will be gaming the game developers using game design principles to inspire and motivate your coworkers. So I hope to hear from all you lead designers and see what you're using to get your team working efficiently and get along with each other, because office politics may be involved.
Well, sometime we'll have to have a separate podcast conversation about this, about secrecy. I find it fascinating. I know many writers and creative artists in other media. Raj, you probably do as well. And it's a game development is such a crazy business. You know, you can't talk about anything. And you know, like novelists that have works coming out years from now can talk.
Writers love to talk. You should use your writers as PR.
Indeed. Yeah, let's start that campaign. I mean, I would love that, because really all you're ever able to do with writers in particular, but game designers in general, is talk about everything in retrospect. Every conversation is in retrospect. This game that came out at this time, or this game that you did, you're never able to talk to them about in process about what they're doing. Anyway, that's my little rant. Roger, Travis from Living Epic Blog and the Video Games and Human Values Initiative. Thanks, Roger. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
Yes, me too. And Justin Cavern from Groping the Elephant. And Justin, you're in the marketplace sort of as we speak, right? Doing a little job hunting.
Yeah, not going too well.
Yeah, well, you and lots of other people, unfortunately. Yep. Best of luck to you.
A bad time. So.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great talking to all of you, and have a good rest of your weekend. Thanks again for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Take care.